Law Focus Podcast.
Good evening and welcome to Law Focus. It has just gone 6 minutes after seven this evening. My name is Millicent Ndiweni and I am with Tshepo Mohapi and we are broadcasting live from VAWFM 88.1. Tonight, we enjoy our second profile interview for the year, where we have in studio a young and dynamic attorney whose journey and experiences to where she is right now are absolutely important and should never be downplayed. Being black, female, and under the age of 30, owning your own law firm in any part of the world, more so in ours, is quite a big deal. And I cannot stress this more. Given our history, we celebrate every single milestone, not only because you managed to overcome all the challenges and becoming one of the exceptions, but also because it encourages others to not give up on their visions despite the odds. It would be amazing to live in a South Africa where, as a black person, as a woman, as a black woman, and many other previously historically disadvantaged, you do not have to work thrice as hard to be recognized, where your efforts, even if it was as minimal as that of a privileged white man, it can be regarded as equal. For your success as the previously marginalized to not be seen as an exception, but rather as a norm.
I remember that we have a good understanding, I hope, at this show, of profile interviews generally and of those of young women in particular. Now, we're very happy to have this young attorney with us, certainly an intelligent lady, who's joining us in studio. She's going to tell us about how she's carved her path, because every story is important and worth being told. Now, what we want to do is inspire you, to encourage you, and to rejuvenate perhaps your journey in the legal profession. Now, to tell us about this is Ms. Jocelyn Fember of Jocelyn Fember Attorneys. And to have your say with any questions, thoughts, or any kind of discussion that's relevant today, you can interact with us on social media at VAWFM on Twitter at VAWFM using the hashtag LawFocus. On Facebook, we're VAWFM. And of course, the landline is 011-717-9881. We always look forward to hearing from you, whichever way you like to do it. Tweet us, you can call us. Either way, we like to hear from you. And for any reason you have to disappear, but you really want to hear this conversation, and I think you will, check out our podcast at vits.journalism.co.za/law or the Vits Radio Academy page on Iono, and as well as our previous shows will be on there.
Yes, Tshepo. But for now, before we get into the main part of the event this evening, we are first going to start off with the hottest stories of the week, where we are going to let you know, you know, of the major legal stories that have been unfolding since a week ago when we were last here. Here are our legal hotspots.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week, it's Legal Hotspots.
Right, it's legal hotspots. Your hottest legal stories of the week. We go over to Cape Town, where we're having the situation with refugees at the Green Market Square. Now, to give you a little bit of background, in October last year, or 2018, I think it was, hundreds of refugees began protesting outside of the United Nations Commissioner for Refugees in St. George's Mall. Now, what they wanted to be, was to be resettled in a different country other than South Africa, and this was because of xenophobic violence, which had occurred in the weeks prior to that. They took refuge in the Methodist Church, that is on Green Market Square, but too many people were there to be accommodated in that church, and people began to live on the street outside the church. This affected the bylaws, and after a very, very long and emotional legal battle, the Cape Town High Court granted the city the right to start moving against them, that is to evict them, particularly from the streets surrounding Green Market Square and the church itself. Of course, many opinions are divided on this, and people feel very strongly given the approach of the refugees themselves, as well as the the demands that have been made and the city's approach to it as well. It's been running for a long time, but eventually the court has decided that they should go and they are now going to be evicted. Of course, I don't think it's going to be the end of the story. We'll watch it closely because I think there'll be more litigation on this question. It's a bit of a difficult one to call, I think. You feel sympathetic. Certainly I do. In my time as a human rights attorney, I was very sympathetic towards these things. I'll be honest with you and say at the moment my sympathy is wearing thin.
Why?
Given the whole approach of this thing, I believe that one of the commissioners of the Human Rights Commission even walked away from the matter, given that he was scared for his own safety at the hands of some of the leaders there. So I'm a little bit torn about this one, but nevertheless the court has spoken and they are going. Let's hope that things get better and that the xenophobic attacks against them stop.
Okay, yeah, no. And we are moving on to another story that's also about human rights and has to do with this time immigrants living in South Africa. We have a very interesting, I think it was a landmark judgment by the Concord last week, where they have basically ruled that children born in South Africa to foreign parents can now apply for citizenship. And I think this is very interesting because before you would know that you weren't able to easily apply for citizenship unless you were a permanent resident or one of your parents was obviously South African. But this is now going to change. The highest court of the land said that some immigrants only know South Africa as home, nothing else. And based on the principle of naturalization, they should be allowed to apply for citizenship upon turning 18, irrespective of when they were born. So basically, what this means is that the judgment will apply retrospectively. So if you were born 30 years ago and your parents are not from South Africa, but you were born in South Africa, you can actually make use of this ruling. So I think that's very important. It's quite big. The Department of Home Affairs opposed the matter, stating that this judgment should only apply to children born after 2013, and that's because 2013 is when this matter was taken to court. But the Concord said, anyone who finds themselves in this situation can apply, despite when you were born. And the case stems from children being born to foreign parents who were turned away by the Department of Home Affairs, and they were told by the department that no applications for naturalizations are being considered at all. And while the department will have now 10 days to deal with this matter, and if they don't do so, then further action will be taken against them. Yeah, that's what happened.
So in effect, we now have an unlimited number of potential South African citizens. Is that what we have?
It's tough because there were children, I can't remember what the term is, but children without an identity where, you know, no country recognizes you, so you don't have any birth certificate that's legit, you can't get an identity, any ID from anywhere. It was a difficult one.
I mean, surely if your parents were displaced from, say, Congo,
yeah,
and you were born in South Africa, you're Congolese. You're just born in South Africa. I mean, that's not a question of citizenship.
That's a change now, Tepo.
It's not a question of citizenship.
Why are you forcing people to be Congolese when they want to be South African?
Well, I'm not saying. I'm just saying that, hang on, we now have potentially an unlimited number of instant South African citizens.
It's going to be an interesting one, given, you know, the xenophobic attacks in our country, the, you know, arguments about resources, unemployment, and I don't know how.
I understand that the department didn't file papers as well correctly, and so one has to wonder what happened there and what effect that might have had on the ruling. Anyway, it is what it is. So we have that now. Anybody who's born here, doesn't matter where they're from, their parents are from, can now apply for South African citizenship upon turning 18. All right, now, the criticism of parole. Following the murder of Tasneem van Wyk, parole has become a real hot topic in the country. Tasneem van Wyk was kidnapped and murdered. Mujahideen Panga.
It's a difficult name.
Yeah, no, man. Pangaka, sorry if I'm butchering that surname. Yeah. And he was a known sex offender. He'd been released on parole for a similar crime. He'd served a fairly lengthy sentence and had been released on parole. Now, South Africans are pretty distraught about it and unhappy about the current parole system. Activists are questioning whether parolees undergo any psychological assessment to determine whether they are rehabilitated or not before they are actually given parole. One of the arguments is that it seems that many prisoners are given parole based on the conditions in in prisons themselves rather than good behavior. So overcrowding and so on is contributing towards the decision to grant parole rather than the circumstances of the individual parolee. In the recent State of the Nation address, President Cyril Ramaphosa said that they wanted to amend the Domestic Violence Act to better protect victims in violent domestic relationships, and to broaden the Sexual Offences Act to categorize sexual offenders whose names must be included in the National Register for Sex Offenders. And it will certainly assist in the parole system as well in the granting of bail in cases that involve gender-based violence. Now, we see that gender-based violence are still major issues in the country, and we'll see how it goes, particularly in recent times when gender-based violence has been used sort of as a ping-pong, even in the highest forum in the country, yeah, where, you know, it was now used as a mudslinging thing. But people are dying. Not people. Women and children are dying at the hands of men in this country. And I can tell you, in my experience, that the parole system is one of our most flawed systems. It really is. It does not really take person into consideration, what they've done and how much they've changed. You get parolees who are essentially reformed, but their crime is perhaps political, and they may never be released, you know, or they have very difficult time to be released. And you get others who've committed really serious offenses, but there's not really a political thing or anything like that, and it's not a prominent crime. And they tend to, just after serving X amount of time, get parole without really having been reformed. And I don't think that it's a real judgment call. It's sort of a numbers thing, you know. We've got too many, let's get rid of some of them. Look, he's done two-thirds of his sentence, let him go,
yeah,
kind of thing. So we really need to look at that.
If it means more prisons.
If it means more prisons, yeah. If it means more. But, I mean, we also have to question why the prisons are overcrowded. In South Africa, you can do time for shoplifting. First offense, you'll do 30 days or whatever, but you can do time. Why are you doing time for shoplifting?
Why are you not being rehabilitated? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So we got to really think why it is that our prisons, A, are overcrowded, and then how we relieve that problem. Because to release the worst of the worst seems to not be working. All right.
20 after 7 right now. We're going to move on. We're about to enter into our interview with the attorney from J. Fember Attorneys, Jocelyn Fember. You want to stay tuned for this one.
Law Focus, handing you your rights.
Hey, welcome back to Law Focus with Millicent and Tepo Mohapi. Okay, so we have in studio Jocelyn Fember. We introduced her earlier on as a young and dynamic, career-filled Black woman who has done amazing things with her career since a young age, to be quite honest. And it's going to be interesting to hear her story from where she started from to where she is right now and even beyond where she is in the year 2020. Welcome to Law Focus, Jocelyn. We are so happy to have you here.
Thank you. Good evening, Millicent. Good evening, Tepo, and also good evening to all of your listeners.
All right.
I hope that the discussion that we have today will bear some insight and that your listeners will be able to take something tangible from the conversation that we have today.
From that introduction, I think they will. Let's start with your own experience, your journey becoming a lawyer. Where did that stem from?
Well, on the surface, to be honest, my entire journey to becoming a lawyer took a relatively short time, if you look at it from the outside. For me, though, it was a lifetime in the making. When we're young, people ask us what we want to be when we grow up. For me, both the question and the answer were often put to me in very quick succession. The question is, what do you want to be when you grow up, Jocelyn? Then without missing a beat, I would always get, you should be a lawyer. You'd make a great lawyer. Around the age of, I'd say, 8 or 9 years old, I really began to internalize that word, lawyer, attorney, legal professional. And I began to ask questions like, what was it? What do lawyers do? Could girls become lawyers? What did they wear? I'd ask my parents, my teachers, my friends. And then when I got old enough, I began to read about the legal profession. And ultimately, I decided that besides becoming an actress and a writer, I wanted to become a lawyer. Mm. Soon enough, the lawyer and the legal profession as a whole pushed the other professions aside and took center stage. I then became single-minded about what I wanted to be when I grew up, and for me, the law was the only option.
That's interesting. And based on the answer that you have just given us, first of all, what then makes a good lawyer? Because when people say, oh, you should be a lawyer, it's like, okay, what makes a good lawyer that makes people see this in me, you know? So how would you answer that? And then secondly, you said you would ask your parents, you know, about the legal profession, what they knew. Growing up, did you know any lawyers, or how, and if you didn't, how difficult was it then to penetrate the industry without any background information of, oh, I know Uncle Aaron is a lawyer, or, you know?
To answer your first question, what makes a good lawyer? I think that there are many things that make a good lawyer. And some of these things came to me at a very young age. Some of them came to me upon only entering the legal profession. And I'll take you through those lessons that I learned and then perhaps provide you with some permutations afterwards. As the years passed in my early life, I went to primary school and to high school. I was a very diligent student, a very hard worker. Often I got prizes and awards. My focus never wavered from the law and what I wanted to do. When the time came, I applied to different universities, both in my province and in others, to do law. And when the time, at the time, I wasn't so learned about what exactly the curriculum entailed. And so I applied for three things. In order of choice, the first choice was law. My second was dramatic art. Mm-hmm. And the third was medicine. So, I mean, I was very diversified in my interests, but at the same time, I would have been okay with doing either three. Even though I wanted to do law, I felt like I needed contingencies in place.
Okay.
After a few weeks, I was offered a place in the LLB program at WITS, and I accepted it. To my surprise, and despite the financial challenges that came with being independent and at university simultaneously, and even though there were many real challenges that still awaited for me along the way, like paying my tuition fees and finding accommodation, also balancing work and studies and, you know, a social life, the desire to be a lawyer and the excitement that accompanied that desire never left me. It was always there waiting for me until I was ready. And that moment of readiness, I believe, came about 2 years into my LLB degree. I'd started the interesting bits of the law degree, you know, the stuff that people get excited about when they watch shows like Suits and How to Get Away with Murder, you know, all of these exciting law shows. My real passion for the law came about learning about criminal law and criminal justice. The way that my mind responded to all the complications and intricacies of the subject intrigued me. My lecturers were passionate about what they did, and to see a future self personified in someone else adds to ambition. So I think that's where the aspect of having something that is familiar around you, to be able to see your future self in that person. So to answer your question, I didn't necessarily have any other legal professionals around me at the point of beginning my journey, but I got that, and I think it was supplemented in the form of me having professors and having teachers who were already embossed in the profession in my secondary environment. Like most people with A-type personalities, in my teens and throughout university, I made a to-do list for my life. So I tend to hoard paper, and during my studies, whenever I felt discouraged or I needed to remind myself of my purpose, I always went looking for that piece of paper. So I think consistency and just constantly reminding yourself why you're doing it, and you know, just an awareness of what your purpose is important as a trait for being a lawyer, because a lot of people enter the profession, or, you know, at a very, very early stage in their life, they decide that they want to be a lawyer, but there isn't really that why. And I think that is critical when deciding that doing the legal profession is what you want to do.
Mm. Now, tell me, you perhaps have answered this in a way, but I'm going to ask it slightly differently. in your practice, you know, as you're going about your journey as an attorney,
yes,
perhaps one of the things that one finds is you can get very cynical. You can get very cynical about people because you're dealing with the underbelly, if I could say, of humanity, whether it's rough guys who are accused of doing quite serious things, or you're dealing with the nasty side of a divorce, the nasty side of a family, the nasty side of labor matters, things like this. It's never the pretty things you're dealing with, and that can make you a bit cynical. How, if you're fairly sensitive like myself, you know, quite a sensitive soul, how do you deal with that sort of cynicism that inevitably creeps in for you? What do you do?
So, indeed, I agree with you that I think that in any field of profession or in any vocation, one has to deal with other human beings. And a complication that arises along the way of dealing with that is that you have to deal with difficult people. You have to deal with people who are different to you. There are all sorts of different things that you have to deal with. And fortunately for me, I've had to do that from a very young age. I entered the workforce at the age of 16. So as a result of that, I've had to deal with people and all of those different intricacies. So it was sort of like a training program for me from a very young age. And what I realized along the way, that my initial disappointments, whether it be related to general disappointments, detours, disappointments in people, or perhaps the choices that they made, all of those things that I pursued were merely preparing me for the moment when I would become an attorney and I would have to find practical ways of making those differences work, or finding a solution despite those difficulties.
Yeah.
And also just preparing me for the moment that, and this is going to sound very poetic, but the moment when I would stand up in the High Court before the two judges who held my fate to take my oath and be added to the role of attorneys. Mm. Now, when I walk into a courtroom, when I bow to the court and I proceed to the bar, I'm taken aback by how this simple act, which may be taken for granted by someone whose journey may not have been as lengthy or as convoluted as my own, means such a great deal to me. I know now that no experiences, no delays, no challenges or detours are ever wasted. So the experience that you speak of, where you have to deal with things that you wouldn't necessarily do yourself, you have to deal with moral dilemmas that, or moral lines that people have crossed that you wouldn't necessarily cross yourself, there's somewhat of a reconciliation, and your purpose is not to judge, you know, the goodness or the badness of that situation. Your purpose as an attorney is to resolve it.
That is so powerful.
Yeah.
That is so powerful. I don't even know where to start. with my follow-up.
But that's true. It really is.
It's
It is not your job to judge. There's a judge for that.
But then can I, Tapo, if you don't mind, taking from just that last portion,
sure,
of not judging. Okay, we haven't asked you what your practice is about, ne? We'll get there.
Okay.
But as a woman, if someone comes to you, you know, you heard us speaking earlier on, we spoke of parole, for instance, you know, where you are dealing with some people who have been hardcore criminals and they have done the most heinous of crimes, especially these gender-based violence crimes that we are dealing with, where it has, you know, femicide combined with rape, you know, those horrendous crimes,
yes,
against women and children. And you say criminal law also really showed you, this is me in future, you know, whether or not you practice it now. If you have someone who approaches you with a history of such violence, having committed such violence, and you are not in a position to judge as a lawyer, you're in a position to solve the case, how do you take it? How does that influence your principles, your strong-held beliefs, biases, prejudices, you know, values? As a woman, how do you deal with that?
So, to answer your question, I think that inherently as human beings, we all have predispositions about what is right and what is wrong.
Sure.
And that is based on the environment that we have either grown up in, been raised in, or found ourselves in subsequent to that. It's all informed by different characteristics and different influences. But the role of an attorney in dealing with matters, like criminal matters, when someone comes to you and says, I've been accused of committing a crime, your purpose in that situation is not to find out from your client whether or not they think what they did is right or wrong, or to decide that what they did is heinous or not. That is not your job. Your duty is to tell your client's story to the court. And in criminal law specifically, and I think that a lot of people have reservations about practicing criminal law for this reason, you know, because of the moral dilemma, because of the guilt that people face when, for instance, someone approaches you as a woman and says, I've been accused of the crime of rape. The question that is often asked is, how can you, as a woman, how can you represent a rapist? And people harbor negative emotions towards attorneys and advocates who practice criminal law. And I think that bias comes from the belief that the attorney is defending the wrong thing or the right thing. No, the attorney is merely interpreting the law in order to tell their client's story. Yeah. And I think in a country like South Africa, where there are so many instances where after a person has been convicted and sentenced, it comes out at a later stage that person actually did not commit the crime. It's important. The role of an attorney and the role of an advocate is so important in telling a person's story to prevent instances of people, for instance, having a wrongful conviction. And also, you know, the question of my own personal values and principles. If anything, I think that the answer to the question as to whether law has influenced my principles and my values lies in an analysis of the ethics and the practices of lawyers in the culture of attorneys. One of the classic questions asked by people who teach and write about lawyers can be, is it possible to be both a good lawyer and a good person? Mm-hmm. One thing that has stood out for me in all of my encounters with interpreting and applying the law is that there are consequences of not living a life of integrity, of honor, of simplicity, of good nature and kindness. I've always aimed at being an excellent attorney and a remarkable person at the same time. The law often operates as a sense, a voice of sense and reason when there is conflict. It's a respected middle ground where people are almost obliged to be temperate. I believe that people become better people when they work with other people on projects of consequence, and that's what we do as attorneys. Through this platform and through the privilege of having worked with so many virtuous lawyers, like some of my professors at the Wits Law Clinic, my director during articles of clerkship, and many of my colleagues, I'm a better person today than I was when I met all of these people, than I was before all of my encounters in the profession.
Okay. Mm.
Yes.
Right, I think let's take a break on this point, then we can come back.
Before we do, just hang on, because that's a question that always comes up, and I think it's somewhat of a difficult one. And I'm going to ask the listener to ask himself this question, because that's something that a lawyer is always asked, is to ask yourself, are you confident that the people who are currently in jail, most of them deserve to be in jail? And I can go to sleep at night saying, yes, I believe the people, most of them, who are convicted, deserve to be in jail. But the only way I can be sure about that is that I know that each of them went to court, had charges pressed against them, they were asked to plead, they were given an attorney to represent them, even for free, to present their version of events. And having presented their version of events, they were found guilty. Nobody thumbsucked their conviction. So for the vast majority of people in jail, they got an opportunity to present their version of events to the court, to the public, and that version was rejected. And that makes me sleep at night. I said, but okay, he got a fair trial. All right. Anyway, let's not get too heavy. That was just a philosophical question. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're talking to Ms. Femba of Jocelyn Femba Attorneys.
Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Hi, welcome back to Law Focus. You're with me, Tepo and Millicent. And today our guest is Jocelyn Femba. She's from J. Femba Attorneys, and that's in Sunning Hill. speciality is criminal law, commercial law, and family law as well. She's a great new attorney. Well, not new, but she has started her new firm, and she is working very hard in the Johannesburg area, making it a far better area for all of us. Jocelyn Fember from J. Fember Attorneys. Right. You can remember to follow us on at Twitter. Oh, my word. What am I saying? At Twitter. What's at Twitter? Remember to follow us on age. You know, age sometimes.
On Twitter. Hey,
and I shaved my head. I shaved my beard to look younger. Shame it's not working. Okay. Twitter. We're on Twitter at VowFM using the hashtag LawFocus. Remember, you can telephone us if you are that way inclined. And on 011717981. We're discussing being an attorney in this country, a young female attorney in Johannesburg. The challenge, the inspirations, the problems, and some of the triumphs that you will experience. Alright, Jocelyn and Millicent, over to you.
Okay, Jocelyn, let's start with before we move to the next phase of your life after university. When you were there as a student, there's many challenges, of course. What were your greatest challenges as a student, and how did you overcome them?
All right, so just to give, just because there are so many different ways to study these days, some people study via UNISA, others do it full-time. I studied at Wits University. I'm a proud Witsy. There were...
Tucks of nooks is what we say.
There were very many challenges I faced which were quite significant, like balancing work and study life, meeting the demands of the academic pressure, achieving social cohesion, and aligning myself with university life culturally in general. But the one thing that I'd like to draw as a focal point of this particular discussion is the issue of despair and depression, as I believe that it deserves attention as the end result of all the challenges which are common for law students, in my own experience. In my experience, the emotional health of law students is a growing issue of concern. During my years at law school, there was a constant perceived hyper-competitive, overly demanding, and I'd say alienating environment. This, for me, it placed the mental health of some law students, including my own, under severe strain. Because of the atmosphere, I noticed that the use of anti-anxiety and antidepressant medication had become the norm among students, and that alcohol was being consumed in alarming proportions. I wasn't necessarily a big drinker. However, it was alarming how often and how much some of my peers consumed alcohol. The more and more that I came across this issue, and as it was brushed off as casual debauchery, in my mind, I always thought that it suggested that a wider problem required urgent attention. I wondered whether there was something about law school in particular that drives its students to mental health problems and substance abuse, and if so, how can the problem be addressed? In seeking answers to, the questions that I asked myself, I first looked into the university's policies and practices on addressing mental health and substance abuse. I then began a very personal investigation into the issue of mental health among law students specifically, looking at South Africa and other countries as well. Through most of the rigorous research on the subject, it did offer some valuable insight, and also just based on my interactions with my peers and, seeing what was happening at law school. There was something very disturbing about my findings, and it was that sizable groups of people, including the groups of students I knew were experiencing problems, were reluctant to seek help. Some of the factors that stopped them from seeking assistance included social stigma, potential threat to job status, because, as you know, law students have to be fit and proper in order to be considered eligible for admission into the profession, financial reasons, and perhaps the idea that they could handle the problem themselves or not having the time. At South African universities particularly, the question of student emotional wellness has been acknowledged and examined in some depth. These studies don't focus on law specifically, but anecdotal evidence suggests that some law students may be experiencing similar pressure, which require personal and professional support and care. So I think that, as much as we can look at all of the common pressures, there's an end result, and I think that end result is the anxiety and the depression that no one knows what to do about. No one knows how to approach it, and it's sort of it bridges across into the profession, because you'll find that even at a professional level, people have substance abuse problems.
Yeah, it's not well talked about, but the pressure can really get to us. Let's go to the lines quickly. We've got a caller, Koketso, who has a question. I'm sure it's for all of us. It's on the death penalty. Let's hear what it is that Koketso would like to say.
Hi, Koketso.
Hi, Jocelyn. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm very proud of the young woman you've become.
Thank you.
And I'm very proud of the fact that you've taken a step that I couldn't take myself and started your own law firm. But I know we've had this debate before, but what do you think of the recent calls of, to bring back the death penalty, especially with regards to sexual violence and crimes against women and children, and murder generally in South Africa?
Thank you for your question, Koketso, and I think that's a very important discussion to be had, not only as a legal professional, but amongst people in society. It's our duty as legal professionals to rationalize the arguments and the conversations that happen in society, much like the call for the return of the death penalty. And I think that what we need to do is, as much as crimes against women and children are incredibly outrageous and unacceptable, we need to ask ourselves what our role in the criminal justice system as a whole is, and what the law's purpose is. And I think in a country like South Africa, where we're a constitutional democracy and we are governed by the provisions of the Constitution, the right to life is deeply entrenched, and the public or people in the courts cannot be the judge, jury and executioner. The right to life is a very sacred right, and I think that it has to be balanced against other rights. But to call for the return of the death penalty would be a step backwards in our democracy. And I think that the problem that instead needs to be addressed is perhaps our criminal justice system, which begins at the police department. I think that those functions need to be readdressed and looked at instead of the call for the death penalty. Because let's say the death penalty does return, our police system would still be broken. There would still be incompetence at that level. So it would not necessarily guarantee a conviction and guarantee that the death penalty would be given to perpetrators of sexual crimes in particular. So I hope that I've answered your question.
Okay, so okay, so let me ask you something before you answer. Are you perhaps wondering whether the death penalty would have an effect on crime? Is that what you're suggesting, perhaps, if it were reintroduced?
Well, my question comes from two levels. Firstly, as Jocelyn rightly said, the right to life is deeply entrenched in our constitution. So is the limitation clause. So I respectfully disagree with Jocelyn. And part of the reason why I disagree with her is because I think it would have an effect on the crime rates.
Okay.
Or the statistics with relation to gender-based violence and murder. I think that it would go a long way in reducing those statistics, because any rational person would fear being executed as punishment for raping
crime.
A child. Yes.
All right. I see what you're saying.
And also, I'm trying to balance the moral, generally the moral standing that if you're going to murder a six-week-old child, or if you're going to rape a six-week-old child, does your right to life really supersede that child's life, right to life? Excuse me.
All right.
It's one of those things, yeah.
All right, I hear what you're saying. I just want to go quickly. You understand that the death penalty kicks in only at the penalty stage of the trial.
Yes, of course.
And so before that, you've got arrest, you've got informally being charged by the police, which is part of the arrest. You must then appear before the prosecutor, be charged by the prosecutor, plead, and then go on trial and then be convicted. And then only at trial on sentencing will the death penalty actually become a factor. And so if it fails at any of those previous six stages that I mentioned, we're not even going to even take into account the death penalty, any penalty for that matter. So are we not now grabbing the tail end of the argument? Is it not the police, the arrest, the charging, the trial portion that needs to be fixed? If you know that you're going to be, if a criminal knows that they're going to be arrested, charged, prosecuted, convicted, will that not be the deterrent? Because if that's not going to happen, they know they're not going to go to jail. It can be on the statute books all they like, but it's not going to deter them if they know they're not going to be caught. What do you say to that?
Not necessarily. Look, I fully understand how the criminal justice system works. And I fully understand that there are several steps before we get to sentencing stage.
Mm.
But that's precisely the point. I agree with you to the extent that enforcement and investigations, etc., do need to be fixed. That is definitely something that should be a priority. But at the same time, the fact that you're going to be arrested is not a deterrent right now. Mm. I'll give you a perfect example. The guy from Cape Town who murdered his neighbor, who went to buy a lollipop from him, and she was found a couple of days later, he was on parole.
Yeah.
He had been arrested, he had been punished, but nothing deterred him from committing the crime again, because being arrested and being sent to jail is not a deterrent. Also, our prison system is really broken, as you're saying.
Right.
And maybe instead of dealing with issues of overcrowding, let's remove the problem and remove the person as well. But that's just my radical view.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I don't know if Jocelyn has anything to add to that.
I just wanted to add that, I mean, if we look at countries that do have the death penalty in force, like Botswana, as an example, because it's very close to home, you still find people committing crimes that have the consequence of the death penalty. So I would respectfully disagree that it would be an effective deterrent. Yeah.
All right.
We don't have much time now, but thank you for your call. And I suppose that's going to be a running debate for as long as we have a very high levels of crime and violence in this country, and very low conviction rates as well. It's always going to be on the table, and I think we should continue to talk about it.
Yeah.
But thanks, Cookies.
Alrighty, bye, guys.
Bye, Cookies.
Okay, there was an interesting call by Gogetso, so I think that needs a show on its own.
Yeah, that
you know. Yeah. But in the meantime, because we really want to talk about Jocelyn and her practice as well, you know, and you know, her contribution to society. Jocelyn, we don't have much time left, but let's talk about you opening your own practice.
Yeah.
You know, soon after becoming admitted. Quickly, briefly, tell us.
Because that's a big.
It's a huge milestone. It's an amazing achievement.
I mean,
thank you.
People really get nervous about that. You get very talented attorneys who simply are just too afraid to step out of getting a salary every month and so on.
Indeed.
So tell us about that. What made you come to that decision, and is it worth it?
Yeah.
All right. So I opened up my own practice about 15 months after being admitted as an attorney. Prior to this, I was retained at the firm that I did articles with, and thereafter I decided to accept an in-house position in the corporate space. I am very passionate about the practice of law and everything associated with it, including being in court very often. So naturally, my tenure as in-house counsel only lasted 3 months. I resigned from the position after being offered a position at a new law firm, which did not work out for me either. And after much introspection, I realized that perhaps my experiences were pushing me into becoming independent.
Mm.
My experience as an article clerk was I had a lot of exposure, so I was thrown deep into the trenches at a very young stage in my legal career. And I think that that's also what has allowed me to enter into my own practice at a very early stage. I've always had very strong leadership skills as well, and as a pervading result, I've always endeavored to have my own business. I didn't expect to have it so soon into my career, but I most certainly think that it happened at the exact point of my readiness to do so.
Yeah.
I knew that... I mean, the reason I'm saying that is because as early as it was, I took on my responsibilities as a firm owner quite naturally. My experience was aligned with the demands of the role I now had to take on. And there was much learning to do, and no one should ever conclude their learning. But going out on my own, notwithstanding the inherent difficulties of starting a new business, was a breath of fresh air for me.
Mm, yeah. Certainly. Well, Jocelyn, perhaps quickly let's give you the platform to tell us more about your business, how we can contact you, anyone who's interested, whether you're receiving young graduates in your firm, employing, please just give us all that information.
Okay. So at J. Fember Attorneys, we are attorneys who specialize in family law, in commercial law, and in criminal law. The firm was founded on the premise of doing away with the traditional system of measuring the value that we as attorneys create by measuring that in billable hours. Our contribution is measured through applying our expertise and skill, and we judge our successes based on the results that we produce for our clients. If your listeners would like to get more information on that, they can visit our website at www.fember.co.za. They can also email us at info@fember.co.za or call us on 066-203-6047.
Okay.
And just quickly on the issue of employing graduates, I think that there are obviously many challenges with recruitment, because often the person that you see is not the person that you end up with. That can be both positive and negative. Sometimes what you see is what you get, and sometimes what you see is not what you get. So I think that it's very difficult, because there's this emphasis on academia and not necessarily on skills output. And, you know, there isn't a way to sort of measure the skills that law graduates carry. But I think that what is important is balance. So as much as academics is important, I think that there need to be practical evaluations in place in order to try and see if people think on their feet.
Yeah.
That balanced with good academic results.
Right. And Tepo, sorry, you know, she used to be on TV before.
Oh,
yeah.
I can believe.
Yeah, that's 15-year-old who started her career like some years ago. Are we ever going to see you in entertainment ever again? You're so versatile.
Thank you very much. I was a child actor.
Yes.
And as much as that was a very enriching experience for me, and it gave me what I needed, I think that, you know, being a legal professional is very demanding. And so on that basis alone, I don't think that I have the capacity at the moment to stand in queues for auditions and to give, you know, the entertainment industry the time that it demands. Okay. Having said that, perhaps I will be the next attorney, or the next celebrity attorney.
Yes,
in the trial of the century.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That's a possibility.
Yeah. That's amazing.
All right. I'm with these guys from, the voice of hip hop with Sizwe. Listen, man. Just wait just a minute. Okay, we're a little bit late today, but it's a really important conversation we're having. We've been talking to Jocelyn Fember of J. Fember Attorneys, and it's for you. You must really, it's for you, because it's very difficult to have that sort of, well, I'm still going to proceed, you know, even things are difficult, I'm struggling to pay my fees, I might not be respected, or I might get pushback in the legal profession, but you have people like Jocelyn who are here just to show you that, listen, I'm a black lady, and it is possible, not only to qualify, to open your own firm, to thrive, it's possible, and in fact, we need you. to do it. Men have been running this country for a long time, and look where it has gotten us. Look at where it's gotten us. Technical recession number what now? I think it's our third technical recession that we're in. I mean, things are not really working good, but you can. You don't need to rely on anybody else. You can do it. Whoever it is that you are, it is possible, okay? And the law profession is changing. You get more and more faces of Jocelyn. When I was there for at my last admission, where a friend of mine was admitted, eight ladies were admitted and only two guys were admitted. And I think four of those ladies were being admitted as conveyancers and notaries. So the legal profession is changing. You can be part of it. Thank you for listening. It's been Tsepo Mapi and Millicent. I think Millicent knows the names that she should thank.
Yeah.
Far
yeah.
better than
Tsepo,
what I do.
Tsepo cheats the system, guys. But I'm going to say, you may remember www.femberattorneys.co.za is the website where you can find more information on Jocelyn's law firm and about Jocelyn herself. Jocelyn, honestly, what you're doing is amazing. All the best with all your future endeavors and congratulations.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope that I've inspired your listeners. Perhaps those listening will look at the legal profession with new eyes, or perhaps decide to join the fraternity.
Definitely, definitely. From our producer, Lerato Makate, our technical producer, Mike, our law focus researchers, Tsepo Mohapi, and myself, Millicent Ndiweni, thank you for tuning into Law Focus tonight.
Law Focus Podcast.